slim to save the rest of the body, just disassociated. Pain here, savior elsewhere. And elsewhere was much more deserving of the save. Just rationalizing as she always had so that she could live with herself. She never outright lied to herself, though. She knew she didn't exist in some moral gray area. She existed entirely in the black. But the only thing worse than Alex doing her job well was someone else doing it badly. Or no one doing it at all. But even if she fully embraced the label monster, she was never the kind of monster who killed innocent people. She wasn't even going to kill this very guilty one, who was still looking up at her from under his long curls with big hazel puppy dog eyes. "Dead babies," she chanted to herself. "Dead babies, dead babies, dead babies." She'd never wanted to be a spy or work undercover, but now she saw that she was also emotionally unsuited for the job. Apparently she had too much gratuitous sympathy floating around inside her body, which was more than ironic. This is why you never talked to your subject before you talked to him. "Okay, Daniel, off we go. Can you stand up?"
"Mm-hmm. Oh, here, let me take your bag."
He lifted a hand weakly toward her briefcase. "I got it." Though in truth, her fingers were pins and needles around the handle. "You need to focus on your balance right now."
"I'm really tired."
"I know. Look, my car is right there. The silver one."
"There are a lot of silver ones."
"Exactly the point." "It's right here. Okay, let's put you in the back so you can lie down. Why don't you take off your coat? I don't want you to get too warm. And the shoes. There we go. Less for her to manage later. Bend your knees up so your legs will fit. Perfect." He had his head pillowed on the backpack now, which surely wasn't that comfortable, but he was past caring.
"You're so nice, Alex,"
he murmured, his eyes closed now.
"You're the nicest woman I ever met."
"I think you're nice too, Daniel," she admitted.
"Thanks,"
he half-articulated. And then he was asleep. Quickly, she pulled the beige throw out of the trunk. It was the same color as the seats. She covered him with it. She pulled a syringe from her bag and inserted it into a vein in his ankle, hunching her body so it blocked any outside view of what she was doing. Follow the leader would wear off in an hour or so, and she needed him to sleep longer than that. Not an agent, she decided. An agent might have played along with her kidnap drug, but he would never have let himself get knocked out like this. The temporary lab she had created was in rural West Virginia. She'd rented a nice little farmhouse with a milking barn that had been a very long time without cows. The exterior of the barn was a white composite siding that matched the house. Inside, the walls and ceiling were lined in aluminum. The floors were sealed concrete with conveniently spaced drains. There was a little bunk room in the back. It had been advertised as extra space for visiting guests. Delightfully rustic. She was sure there were many naive travelers who would find the rusticity charming, but all she cared was that the electricity and water were hooked up and running. The farmhouse and barn were situated in the middle of a 240-acre apple orchard, which was in turn surrounded by more acres of farmland. The closest neighbor was over a mile away. The owners of this orchard were making money during the off-season by renting out the space to city dwellers who wanted to pretend they were roughing it. It was very expensive. She frowned every time she thought about the price, but it couldn't be helped. She needed a secluded facility with a usable space. She'd been working nights to get everything ready. During the day, she had followed Daniel from a good distance, then caught up on what sleep she could in the car during school hours. She was completely exhausted at the moment, but she still had a lot to do before her workday was over. First stop, a minor freeway exit more than an hour out of the city. A narrow dirt road that looked as if no one had used it in a decade took her deeper into the trees. It must have led somewhere, but she didn't drive far enough to see where. She stopped under a thick patch of shade, cut the engine, and went to work. If Daniel was employed by the department, or more likely, one of the organizations that worked closely with it, the CIA, a few military sections, some other black ops floaters that, like the department, didn't have official names, he would have an electronic tracker on him, just like she'd once had. Absently, she rubbed her finger across the small raised scar on the nape of her neck, covered by her short hair. They liked to tag the head. If only one part of a body could be recovered, the head was best for identification purposes. She opened the back passenger side door and knelt on the damp ground beside Daniel's head. She started with the place both she and Barnaby had been tagged, brushing her fingers lightly along his skin, then again, pressing harder. Nothing. She'd seen a few foreign subjects whose trackers had been freshly removed from behind their ears, so she checked there next. Then she ran her fingers through his hair, probing the scalp for any bumps or hard spots that shouldn't be there. His curls were very soft and smelled nice, citrusy. Not that she cared about his hair, but at least she didn't have to put her hands into some greasy, malodorous nest. She appreciated that. Now for the heavy lifting. If it was De La Fuentes keeping tabs on this man, the tracker would probably be external. She threw the shoes into the woods beside the road first. They seemed the most likely culprit of his clothes. Lots of men would wear the same pair every day. Then she stripped off his shirt, grateful for the button-down, though it was still hard to get it out from under the weight of his body. She didn't bother trying to get the undershirt over his head. She pulled a blade from her pocket, untaped it, and cut the fabric into three easily removable pieces. She scanned his chest. No suspicious scars or lumps. The skin on his torso was fairer than his arms. He had a faint farmer's tan, no doubt from building houses in Mexico with a t-shirt on, or from acquiring superviruses in Egypt, also very sunny. He had what she thought of as sports muscles rather than gym muscles. No hard-cut edges, just a nice, smooth alignment that showed he was active without being obsessive. Rolling him onto his stomach was hard, and he fell into the foot space, draped over the hump between seats. He had two light scars on his left shoulder blade, parallel and even in length. She explored them carefully, prodding the skin all around, but she couldn't feel anything besides the normal fibrous, hypertrophic tissue that should be there. It didn't take her long to realize she should have removed his jeans before rolling him over. She had to climb on top of his awkwardly positioned form and reach both arms around his torso to get the button fly open. So very thankful that he was not wearing skinny jeans. She then climbed out the other passenger side door and yanked the pants off over his feet. She was unsurprised to see that he wore boxers rather than briefs. It fit his clothing profile. She stripped the boxers off, then the socks, and then she grabbed up the rest of the clothes, walked them a few feet off the road, and stuffed them behind a fallen log. She made another trip for the backpack. The laptop would be a very good hiding place for any electronic device someone wanted him to carry around unknowingly. This wasn't the first time she'd had to strip a target down herself. In the laboratory environment, she'd had people who prepped a subject for her. Barnaby called them the underlings, but she hadn't always been in the lab, and during her first field trip to Herat, Afghanistan, she'd learned to be deeply grateful to the underlings. Stripping down a man who hadn't bathed in months was not pleasant, especially when she didn't have a shower available for herself afterward. At least Daniel was clean. She was the only one working up a sweat today. She found the screwdriver in the trunk and quickly changed the DC license plate for one she'd pulled off a similar car in a West Virginia scrapyard. Just to be thorough, she did a cursory examination of the backs of his legs, the bottom of his feet, and his hands. She'd never seen a tracker on the extremities, probably because extremities sometimes got cut off to make a point. She didn't see any scars. She also didn't see any calluses that suggested he'd trained with guns or used them frequently. He had soft teacher hands, with just a few hard spots that spoke of blisters from inexperienced labor.
She tried to roll him back up onto the seat, but quickly realized it was a vain effort. It wasn't a comfortable sleeping position, but he wouldn't wake up regardless. He would be sore later. Though it was completely ridiculous to even think of that. As she repositioned the blanket and tucked it around his body as best she could, she was constructing a story about him from the documents she'd read and the evidence in front of her. She believed Daniel Beach was mostly the man she saw now, the pleasant, all-around good guy. The attraction for the avaricious ex was understandable. He was probably easy to fall in love with. After some time had passed, enough time for the ex to take love for granted, she would have been able to shift her focus to the things she didn't have. The nice apartment, the big ring, the cars. She probably missed this side of Daniel now, the grass always being greener and whatnot. But there was also darkness in Daniel, buried deep, perhaps born from the pain and unfairness of losing his parents, aggravated by his wife's betrayal, and then ignited by the loss of his final family member. That darkness would not surface easily. He would compartmentalize it, keep it away from this gentle life, pack it into the dark spaces where it fit. No wonder he could speak of Mexico so blithely. He would have two Mexicos, the happy one the teacher loved, and the dangerous one the monster thrived in. They probably weren't anything close to the same place in his head. Not a true psychotic, she hoped. Just a fractured man who didn't want to give up the person he thought of as himself, but who needed the release the darkness gave him. She felt comfortable with this assessment, and it changed her plan a little. There was a great deal of performance to what she did. For some subjects, the very clinical and emotionless persona worked best. White coat, surgical mask, and shiny stainless steel. For others, it was the threat of the crazed sadist, though Barnaby was always more successful with that play. He had the face and hair for it. Unruly spikes of white. I've just been electrocuted hair. Every situation was slightly different. Some feared the darkness, some the light. She'd been planning to go clinical. It was the most comfortable role in her wheelhouse. But she decided now that Daniel would need to be surrounded by darkness to let that side come to the surface. And Dark Daniel was the one she needed to talk to. She did a little evasive driving on the way in. If someone had been tracking Daniel's clothes or possessions, she didn't want that person coming along any farther on this trip. She considered the possibilities again for the millionth time. Column one, this was a very elaborate trap. Column two, this was for real and a million lives were on the line. Not to mention her own. During her long drive, the balance finally shifted to rest solidly on one side. This wasn't a government agent in her car. She was sure of that. And if he was an innocent citizen, picked at random to draw her out, then they'd already missed their best opportunities to bag her. There hadn't been one attack, not one attempt to follow her, that she'd seen. She thought of the mountains of incriminating information on Daniel Beach, and she couldn't help herself. She was a believer, so she'd better get to work saving lives. She pulled into the farmhouse drive around 11, dead tired and starving, but 95% sure that there was no trail that could lead either the department or De La Fuentes to her doorstep. She looked the house over quickly, checking to see if anyone had broken in and died, as he or she would have upon opening the door. And then, after disarming her safeguards, she drove the car into the barn. As soon as she'd pulled the barn door shut and reset the alarm, she went to work getting Daniel prepped. All the other tasks were done. She'd bought timers from a Home Depot in Philly and plugged lamps into them in several rooms of the farmhouse. Like a traveler leaving for a few weeks, she made certain that the place looked occupied. A radio was plugged into one of the timers, so there would be noise, too. The house was good bait. Most people would clear that before progressing to the dark barn. The barn would stay dark. She'd constructed a kind of tent in the middle of the barn space
that would hide light and muffle sound, while also keeping Daniel completely ignorant of his surroundings. It was a rectangular cube, about 7 feet high, 10 feet wide, and 15 feet long. It was constructed of PVC pipe, black tarps, and bungee cords, and it was lined inside with two layers of egg foam duct-taped into place. It was rough, but more functional than a cave, and she'd handled that in the past. In the center of the tent was an oversized metal slab with black accordion legs that could be adjusted for height. It had been on display in the barn, for authenticity, no doubt, and was some kind of veterinarian's operating table. It was bigger than she needed. This vet had been dealing with cows, not kittens, but still quite a find. It was one of the items that had pushed her over the edge into renting this extortionate tourist trap. There was another metal top table that she'd set up as a desk with her computer, the monitors, and a tray of things that would hopefully only be props. The IV pole was next to the head of the table, a bag of saline already hanging. A wheeled metal cart from the kitchen was positioned beside the pole. A mass of tiny but ominous-looking syringes were lined up in easy view on a stainless steel tray. There was a gas mask and a pressure cuff on the wire rack below the syringes. And, of course, the restraints she'd bought on eBay, prison medical facility grade, which she'd chained into place through holes she'd laboriously drilled into the stainless steel slab. No one was escaping from those restraints without outside help. And that helper might need a blowtorch. She'd left herself two exits, just openings in the tarp like the partings in a curtain. Outside the tent, she had a cot, her sleeping bag, a hot plate, a small refrigerator, and all the other things she would need. There was a little three-piece bathroom attached to the bunkhouse, but it was too far away for her to sleep in, and there was no tub anyway, just a shower. She'd have to forego her usual arrangements this weekend. She used mover straps to haul Daniel's inert form out of the car and onto a refrigerator dolly, bumping his head a few times in the process. Probably not hard enough to cause a concussion. Then she wheeled him to the table, set it to its lowest height, and rolled him onto it. He was still deeply under. She positioned him on his back, arms and legs extended about 45 degrees from his body, then raised the table. One by one, she locked the restraints into place. He would not be moving out of this pose for a while. The IV was next. Luckily, he was fairly well hydrated, or maybe he just had really great veins. She got the line placed easily and started the drip. She added a parenteral nutrition bag next to the saline. This was all the sustenance he would get for the next 3 days, if it took that long. He'd be hungry, but his mind would be sharp when she wanted it to be. She put the pulse oximeter on his toe. He'd be able to pull it off a finger, and the dry electrodes on his back, one under each lung, to monitor his respiration. A quick swipe of the electric thermometer across his forehead told her that his current temperature was normal. She wasn't as practiced with the bladder catheter, but it was a fairly simple procedure, and he wasn't in any state to protest if she did something wrong. There would be enough cleaning up without urine to deal with, too. Thinking of that, she placed the absorbent plastic-lined squares, made for house-training puppies, on the floor all around the operating table. There would definitely be vomit if they needed to go past phase one. Whether there would be blood depended on how he responded to her normal methods. At least she had working plumbing here. It was turning chilly in the barn, so she covered him with the blanket. She needed him to stay under for a while longer, and cold against his bare skin wouldn't help with that. After a moment of hesitation, she got one of the pillows off a bunkroom bed, brought it back, and placed it under his head. "It's just because I don't want him to wake up," she assured herself. "Not because he looked uncomfortable." She inserted a small syringe into the IV port and gave him another dose of the sleeping agent. He should be good for at least 4 hours. Finally, she slipped the gas mask over his face and screwed a canister onto it. If her safety precautions killed Daniel, she couldn't get the information she needed. She did a final patrol around the perimeter. Through the windows, she could see that all the correct lights were on in the farmhouse. In the dead stillness of the night,
she thought she could hear the faint strains of Top 40 pop. Once she was sure that every point of ingress was secured, she ate a protein bar, brushed her teeth in the little bathroom, set her alarm for 3, touched her gun under the cot, hugged her canister to her chest, and then sank into the folds of her sleeping bag. Her body was already asleep, and her brain wasn't far behind. She just had time to slip on her own gas mask before she was totally unconscious. Chapter 6. By 3:30 in the morning, she was up, dressed and fed, still exhausted but ready to start. Daniel slept on, oblivious and peaceful. He would feel well-rested when he woke up, but disoriented. He would have no idea what time or even what day it was. Discomfort was an important tool in her line of work. She took his pillow and blanket away, acknowledging the regret this made her feel. But this was important, regardless of training. Every subject felt great discomfort being naked and helpless in front of the enemy. Regret would be the last feeling she would allow herself for a few days. She closed off the rest. It had been more than 3 years, but she could feel things shutting down inside of her. Her body remembered how to do this. She knew she had the strength she would need. Her hair was still wet from the quick color job, and the makeup felt thick on her face, though she wore very little, really. She didn't know how to do anything complicated, so she'd just smeared on dark shadow, thick mascara, and oxblood red lipstick. She hadn't planned to adjust her hair color this soon, but black hair and the camouflage on her face were part of the new strategy. The white lab jacket and pale blue scrubs she'd brought lay crisply folded in her bag. Instead, she was in the tight black shirt again with black jeans. It was a good thing the farmhouse had a washer and dryer. The shirt was going to need a wash soon. Well, it needed one yesterday, actually. It was strange how a little colored powder and grease could change an observer's perception of you. She checked herself in the bathroom mirror and was pleased by how hard her face looked. How cold. She ran a comb through her hair, slicking it straight back, then walked through the barn to her interrogation room. She'd set up floodlights that hung from the PVC structure overhead, but she left them off now, just turning on 2 portable work lights that stood waist high. The black duct tape and gray egg foam looked the same color in the shadows. The air temperature had dropped as the night progressed. There were goosebumps on the subject's arms and stomach. She ran the thermometer across his forehead again, still within the normal range. Finally, she turned on her computer and set up the protocols. It would go to screensaver after 20 minutes of inactivity. On the other side of her computer was a small black box with a keypad on top and a tiny red light on the side. But she ignored that now and went to work. There was a feeling that struggled to break through to the surface as she injected the IV port with the chemical that would bring the subject around, but she suppressed it easily. Daniel Beach had 2 sides, and so did she. She was her other self now, the one the department called the chemist, and the chemist was a machine, pitiless and relentless. Her monster was free now. Hopefully, his would come out to play. The new drug trickled into his veins, and his breathing became less even. 1 long-fingered hand fisted and pulled against the restraint. Although he was still mostly unconscious, a frown touched his features as he tried to roll onto his side. His knees twisted, tugging against the fetters on his ankles, and suddenly his eyes flew open. She stood quietly at the head of the table and watched him panic. His breathing spiked, his heart rate increased, his body thrashed against his bonds. He stared wildly into the darkness, trying to understand where he was, to find something familiar. He stopped suddenly, tense and listening.
"Hello?"
he whispered. She stood still, waiting for the right moment. For 10 minutes, he alternated between wildly yanking against the restraints and trying to listen around the harsh noise of his breathing.
"Help!" he finally called out loudly. "Is anyone there?"
"Hello, Daniel," she answered in a quiet voice. His head jerked back,
stretching his throat as he looked for where the voice was coming from. It wasn't the instinct of a professional soldier, she noted, to expose the throat that way.
Who's there? Who is that?
It doesn't really matter who I am, Daniel.
Where am I?
Also not relevant.
What do you want?
He half-shouted. There you go. You got it. That's the question that matters. She walked around the table so he could focus on her, though she was still lit from behind, and her face would be mostly shadows.
I don't have anything, he protested. No money, no drugs, I can't help you.
I don't want things, Daniel. I need information. And the only way you're getting out of here is if you give it to me.
I don't know anything. Nothing important. Please, stop it!
She snapped loudly, and he sucked in a shocked breath.
Are you listening to me now, Daniel?
This part is really crucial. He nodded, blinking fast. I have to have this information. There is no other option. And if I have to, Daniel, I will hurt you until you tell me what I need to know. I will hurt you badly. I don't necessarily want to do this, but it doesn't bother me to do it either. I'm telling you this so that you can decide now, before I begin. Tell me what I want to know, and I will free you. It's that simple. I promise I will not harm you. It will save me time and yourself a lot of suffering. I know you don't want to tell me, but please realize that you are going to tell me anyway. It may take a while, but eventually you won't be able to stop yourself. Everyone breaks. So make the easy choice now. You'll be sorry if you don't. Do you understand? She had given this same speech to many, many subjects in her career, and it was usually quite effective. About 40% of the time, this was when the subject would start confessing. Not often finish confessing, of course, and there was always some exploratory work to do, but there was a decent chance the first admission of guilt and some partial information might be surrendered now. The statistic varied depending on who she was giving the speech to. Roughly half the time with most military men, the first divulgence would happen before any pain was administered. Only 5 to 10% of the actual spies would say anything without some physical distress. Same numbers for religious zealots. For the low-level toadies, the speech worked 100% of the time. The man in charge had never once confessed a single detail without pain. She really hoped Daniel was just a glorified toady. He stared back at her while she spoke, his face frozen in fear. But then, as she was concluding, confusion narrowed his eyes and pulled his brows together. It wasn't an expression she'd expected. Do you understand me, Daniel? His voice bewildered.
Alex? Alex, is that you?
This was exactly why one didn't make contact with a mark beforehand. Now she was off script. Of course that's not my real name, Daniel, you know that.
What?
My name isn't Alex.
But you're a doctor. You helped me.
I'm not that kind of doctor, Daniel, and I didn't help you. I drugged you and I kidnapped you. His face was sober.
You were kind to me.
She had to control a sigh. I did what I had to do to get you here. Now I need you to focus, Daniel. I need you to answer my question. Are you going to tell me what I want to know? She saw doubt in his expression again. Disbelief that she would actually hurt him. That this was really happening.
I'll tell you anything you want to know. But like I said, I don't know anything important. I don't have any bank account numbers or, I don't know, treasure maps or anything. Certainly not anything worth all this.
He tried to gesture with his trust hand. Looking at himself as he did, he seemed to realize for the first time that he was naked. His skin flushed, face, neck, and a line down the center of his chest, and he pulled automatically against the restraints as if trying to cover himself. His breathing and heart rate started spiking again. Nudity. Whether black ops agents or just low-level terrorist gophers, they all hated it. I don't want a treasure map. I'm not doing this for personal gain, Daniel. I'm doing this to protect innocent lives. Let's talk about that.
I don't understand. How can I help with that? Why wouldn't I want to?
She didn't like the way this was going. The ones who clung to the claim of ignorance and innocence often took longer to break than the ones who owned their guilt, but were determined not to sell out their government, or their jihad, or their comrades. She walked to the desk and picked up the first picture. It was one of the very clear surveillance shots of De La Fuentes. A close-up. "Let's start with this man," she said, holding the photo at his eye level and using one of the work lights as a spot. Perfectly blank. Absolutely no reaction. A bad sign.
"Who is that?"
She allowed her sigh to be audible this time. "You're making the wrong choice, Daniel. Please think about what you're doing."
"But I don't know who that is."
She fixed him with a resigned stare.
"I'm being completely honest, Alex. I don't know that man."
She sighed again. "Then I suppose we'll get started." The disbelief was there again. She'd never dealt with that in an interrogation before. All the others who'd been on her table had known what they were there for. She'd faced terror and pleading and occasionally stoic defiance, but never this strange, trusting, almost challenge. "You won't hurt me."
Is this some kind of fetish fantasy thing?"
he asked in a low voice, somehow finding a way to sound embarrassed despite the bizarreness of his circumstances.
"I don't really know the rules for that stuff."
She turned away to hide an inappropriate smile. "Get a grip," she ordered herself, trying to keep the movement smooth, as if she'd meant to walk away at that exact moment. She went to her desk. She clicked one key on her computer, keeping it awake. Then she picked up the prop tray. It was heavy, and some of the props clanked against each other as she moved it. She brought the tray to his side, rested the edge of it beside the syringes, and angled the light so the metallic implements shone brightly. "I'm sorry you find this confusing," she said in an even voice. "I am in deadly earnest, I assure you. I want you to look at my tools." He did, and his eyes grew very wide. She watched for some hint of the other side to break through, the dark Daniel, but there was nothing. His eyes were somehow still gentle, even in abject fear. Innocent. Lines spoken by Hitchcock's Norman Bates flashed through her head. "I think I must have one of those faces you can't help believing." She shuddered, but he didn't notice, his eyes fixed on her props. "I don't have to use these very often," she told him, touching the pliers lightly, then stroking her finger along the extra-large scalpel. "They call me in when they would like to have the subject left more or less intact." She brushed the bolt cutters on the hard syllable of the last word. "But I don't really need these tools anyway." She flicked her fingernail against the canister of the welding torch, producing a high-pitched pinging sound. "Can you guess why?" He didn't respond, frozen in horror. He was starting to see now. Yes, this was real. Only Dark Daniel must already have known that. So why wasn't he surfacing? Did he think she could be fooled, or that his charm on the train had melted her weak, womanly heart? "I'll tell you why," she said in a voice so low it was almost a whisper. She leaned in conspiratorially and held her face in a sweet, regretful half-smile that didn't touch her eyes. "Because what I do hurts so much worse." His eyes looked like they were going to bug out of his head. This, at least, was a familiar reaction. She took the tray away, letting his focus move naturally to the long line of syringes left behind, glinting in the light. "The first time will last only 10 minutes, she told him, still facing away as she set the tools back on the desk. She spun around. "But it will feel like a lot longer. This will just be a taste. You could look at it as a warning shot. When it's done, we'll try talking again." She picked up the syringe on the far end of the tray, pushed the plunger till a drop of liquid dewed at the top, then flicked it away theatrically, like a nurse in a movie.
"Please," he whispered. "Please, I don't know what this is about. I can't help you. I swear I would if I could."
"You will," she promised, and she stabbed the needle into his left triceps brachii. The reaction was nearly instantaneous. His left arm spasmed and jerked against the restraint. While he stared in horror at his convulsing muscles, she quietly picked up another syringe and crossed to his right side. He saw her approach.
"Alex, please!" he yelled.
She ignored him and his attempts to somehow evade her, as if he were strong enough to rip free of his cuffs, and injected this dose of lactic acid into his right quad. His knee wrenched flat, the muscles pulling his foot off the table. He gasped and then groaned. She moved deliberately, not in any hurry, but not slowly either. Another syringe. His left arm was already too incapacitated for him to try to resist her. This time, she injected the acid into his left biceps brachii. Immediately, the opposing triceps muscle group began tearing against the biceps, battling for contraction dominance. The air burst out of his mouth like he'd just been punched in the gut, but she knew the pain was much, much worse than any blow. One more injection, this time into his right biceps femoris. The same ripping struggle that was happening in his arm started in his leg, and the screaming started with it. She went to stand by his head, watching dispassionately while the tendons in his neck strained into white ropes. When he opened his mouth to scream again, she shoved a gag in. If he bit off his tongue, he wouldn't be able to tell her anything. She walked slowly to her desk chair while his muffled shrieks were absorbed into the double layer of foam, sat down, and crossed her legs. She looked at the monitors, everything elevated but nothing in the danger zone. A healthy body could experience a lot more pain than most people would think before its important organs were really in any serious peril. She brushed the touchpad on her computer, keeping the screen brightly lit. Then she pulled her wristwatch out of her pocket and laid it across her knee. This was mostly for theatrics. She could have watched the clock on her computer or the monitors just as easily. She faced him while she waited, her face composed and the silver watch bright against her black clothing. Subjects tended to find this disconcerting, that she could watch her handiwork so dispassionately. So she stared at him, expression polite, an audience member at a mediocre play, while his body thrashed and distorted on the table and his screams choked past the gag. Sometimes his eyes were on her, pleading and agonized, and other times they whirled crazily around the room. 10 minutes could be a very long time. His muscles started to spasm independently of each other, some locking into knots and others seeming to want to jerk themselves off the bone. Sweat ran off his face, darkening his hair. The skin over his cheekbones looked ready to split. The screams lowered in pitch, turned hoarse, sounding much more like an animal's than a man's. 6 more minutes. And these weren't even the good drugs. Anyone who was sick enough to want to could duplicate the pain she was inflicting now. The acid she was using wasn't a controlled substance. It was fairly easy to acquire online, even if one happened to be on the run from the dark underbelly of the U.S. government. Now, back in her interrogating prime, when she had her beautiful lab and her beautiful budget, her sequencer and her reactor, she'd been able to create some truly unique and ultra-specific preparations. The chemist really wasn't the proper code name for her at all. However, the molecular biologist was probably too big a mouthful. Barnaby had been the chemistry expert, and the things he'd taught her had kept her alive after she'd lost her lab. She had become her code name in the end. But in the beginning, it had been her theoretical research with monoclonal antibodies that had brought her to the department's attention. It was a shame she couldn't risk taking Daniel to the lab. This operation would have produced results much more quickly. And she'd been so close to actually removing pain from the equation. That had been her holy grail, though no one else seemed eager for it. She was sure that if she'd been working in the lab for the past 3 years instead of running for her life, by now she would have created the key that would unlock whatever one needed from the human mind. No torture, no horror. Just quick answers, given pleasantly, and then an equally pleasant trip to either a cell or the execution wall. They should have let her work. Still 4 minutes to go. She and Barnaby had discussed different strategies for dealing with these periods of the interrogation. Barnaby had told himself stories. He would remember the fairy tales from his childhood and think of modern versions or alternative endings or what would happen if the characters switched places. He'd said some of the ideas he came up with were pretty good, and when he had time, he was going to write them down. She, however, felt like she was wasting time if she wasn't doing something practical. She would plan things. In the beginning, she planned new versions of the monoclonal antibody that would control brain response and block neural receptors. Later, she planned her life on the run, thinking of everything that could possibly go wrong, every worst-case scenario, and what she could do to keep herself from falling into each trap. Then, how to escape the trap halfway in. Then, after it was sprung. She tried to envision every possibility. Barnaby said she needed to take a mental break now and then, have some fun, or what was the point of living? Just living, she had decided. Just living was all she asked. And so she put in the mental effort needed to make that possible. Today, she thought about the next step. Tonight, tomorrow night, or heaven help him, the night after that, Daniel was going to tell her everything. Everyone broke. It was just a simple fact that a human being could resist pain for only so long. Some people could deal better with one kind or another, but that meant she would just switch to another type of pain. At some point, if he didn't talk, she would roll Daniel onto his stomach so he wouldn't choke on his own vomit and administer what she called the green needle, though the serum was actually clear, just like all the others. If that didn't work, she'd try one of the hallucinogens. There was always a new way to feel pain. The body had so many different ways to experience stimuli. Once she had what she needed, she would stop his pain, put him under, and then email Karsten from this IP address and tell him everything she'd learned. Then she would drive away and keep going for a very long time. Maybe Karsten and company wouldn't come after her. Maybe they would. And she might never know, because she would most likely keep hiding until she died. Hopefully, of natural causes. Before 9 minutes were over, the dose started to wear off. It was different for everyone, and Daniel was on the larger side. His screams turned to groans as his body slowly melted into a pile of exhausted flesh on the table. And then he was quiet. She removed the gag, and he gasped for air. He stared at her with awed horror for one long moment, and then he started to cry. "I'll give you a few minutes," she said. "Collect your thoughts." She left through the exit he couldn't see, then sat quietly on the cot and listened to him choke back his sobs. Crying was normal, and usually it boded well, but it was obvious that this crying was Daniel the teacher. There was still no sign of dark Daniel. Not one knowing glance or defensive tick. What would reach him? If this was truly dissociative identity disorder, could she force an appearance of the personality she wanted? She needed an actual shrink on her team today. If she'd gone docilely into the lab, as they'd wanted, they probably would have been able to find her one almost the moment she asked. Well, there was nothing she could do about it now. She quietly ate a soft breakfast bar while she waited for his breathing to even out, and then she ate a second. She washed it down with a box of apple juice out of the mini-fridge. When she re-entered the tent, Daniel was gazing despairingly at the egg foam ceiling. She walked quietly to the computer and touched a key. "I'm sorry you had to go through that, Daniel." He hadn't heard her enter. He cringed as far away from the sound of her voice as he could. "Let's not do it again. Okay?" she said. She settled back into her chair. I want to go home, too. Kind of a lie, but also mostly true, if impossible. And though you might not believe me, I'm not actually a sadist. I don't enjoy watching you suffer. I just don't have another choice. I'm not going to let all those people die. His voice was raw.
I don't know what you're talking about.
You'd be surprised how many people say that, and keep saying it for round after round of what you just went through. And worse. And then on the 10th round for one, on the 17th for another, suddenly the truth comes pouring out. And I get to tell the good guys where to find the warhead or the chemical bomb or the disease agent. And people stay alive, Daniel.
I haven't killed anyone, he rasped.
But you're planning to, and I'm going to change your mind.
I would never do that.
She sighed. This is going to take a long time, isn't it?
I can't tell you anything I don't know. You've got the wrong person.
I've heard that one a lot, too, she said lightly. But it touched a nerve. If she couldn't get the other Daniel to appear, then wasn't she truly torturing the wrong person? She made a snap decision to go off script again, though she was out of her depth when it came to mental illness. Daniel, do you ever have blackouts? A long pause.
What?
Have you, for example, woken up somewhere and not known how you got there? Has anyone ever told you that you did or said something that you can't remember doing or saying?
No. Well, today, I mean, that's what you're saying, right? That I'm planning to do something awful, but I don't know what it is?
Have you ever been diagnosed with dissociative identity disorder?
No. Alex, I'm not the crazy person in this room.
That didn't help at all. Tell me about Egypt. He turned his head toward her. His expression made the words he was thinking as clear as if he'd spoken them out loud.
Are you kidding me, lady?
She just waited. He sighed a pained little gasp.
Well, Egypt has one of the longest histories of any modern civilization. There is evidence that Egyptians were living along the Nile as early as the 10th millennium BC. By about 6,000 BC...
That's hilarious, Daniel. Can we be serious now?
I don't know what you want. Are you testing to see if I'm really a history teacher? I can't even tell.
She could hear the strength coming back into his voice. The nice thing about her drugs was that they wore off quickly. She could have a focused conversation between rounds, and she'd found that the subjects had a greater fear of pain when they weren't feeling any. The high ups and deep downs seemed to speed things along. She touched a key on her computer. Tell me about your trip to Egypt.
I've never been to Egypt.
You didn't go there with Habitat for Humanity 2 years ago?
No. I've been in Mexico for the past 3 summers.
You do know people keep track of these things, right? That your passport number is logged into a computer and there's a record of where you've gone?
Which is why you should know I was in Mexico.
Where you met Enrique de la Fuentes.
Who?
She blinked her eyes slowly, her face very bored.
Hold on, he said,
staring up like an explanation might be posted on the ceiling.
I know that name. It was on the news a while ago. With those DEA officers that went missing. He's a drug dealer, right?
She held up the picture of De La Fuentes again.
That's him?
She nodded.
Why do you think I know him?
She answered slowly. Because I also have pictures of you together. And because he's given you $10 million in the past 3 years. His mouth dropped open, and the word came out as a gasp.
What?
$10 million in your name, scattered around the Cayman Islands and Swiss banks. He stared at her for another second, and then anger suddenly twisted his face, and his voice turned harsh.
If I've got $10 million, then why do I live in a roach-infested walk-up studio in Columbia Heights? Why are we using the same patched volleyball uniforms that the schools had since 1973? Why do I ride the metro while my ex-wife's new husband drives around town in a Mercedes? And why am I getting rickets from eating a steady diet of ramen.
She let him vent. The desire to talk was a small step in the right direction. Unfortunately, this angry Daniel was still the schoolteacher version, just not a very happy schoolteacher.
Wait a minute, what do you mean you have pictures of me with the drug guy?
She walked to her desk and pulled the appropriate photo. In Elminia, Egypt, with De La Fuentes, she announced as she held the photo in front of his face. Finally, a reaction. His head jerked back, his eyes narrowed, then opened wide. She could almost watch his thoughts move as they ran through his brain and settled in his face. He was analyzing what he was looking at and making a plan. Still, no sign of the other Daniel, but at least he seemed to recognize that other part of himself. Do you want to tell me about Egypt now, Daniel? Tight lips.
I've never been there. That's not me.
I don't believe you, she sighed. Which is really too bad because we've got to move this party along. The fear came back, fast and hard.
Alex, please, I swear that isn't me. Please don't.
This is my job, Daniel. I have to find out how to save those people. All the reticence disappeared.
I don't want to hurt anyone. I want you to save them too.
It was harder not to believe his sincerity now. That picture meant something to you. He shook his head once, expression closing up.
It wasn't me.
She had to admit she was more than a little fascinated. This was really something new. How she wished she had Barnaby to consult. Oh well, she was on the clock. She didn't have time for wishing. She stacked the syringes one by one onto her left palm. 8 this time. He stared at her with terror and sadness. He started to say something, but no sound came out. She paused with the first needle ready in her right hand. Daniel, if you want to say something, do it quick. Dejected.
It won't help.
She waited another second, and he looked straight at her.
It's just your face, he said. It's the same as before. Exactly the same.
She flinched, then pivoted, and moved up the table to stand beside his head. He tried to strain away from her, but that just better exposed his sternocleidomastoid. Usually she'd save this particular muscle for later in the interrogation. It was one of the very most painful things she could do to a subject under her current limitations. But she wanted to leave quickly, so she stabbed the needle into the side of his neck and pushed the plunger down. Without really looking at him, she replaced the gag as soon as his mouth opened. Then, dropping the other syringes, she escaped the room. Chapter 7. She was rusty, that was all. It had been 3 years. That's why she was feeling things. That's why this subject was affecting her. It was nothing except her having been out of the game so long. She could still get her groove back. She entered the room once during this session to keep the computer alive, but didn't stay to watch. She came back only after the dose was waning, about 15 minutes later. He lay there, gasping again, but this time he didn't cry, though she knew the pain had been much worse than before. Blood from his chafed skin now stained all the restraints and dripped onto the table. She might need to paralyze him for the next round so his injuries didn't get any worse. That was a frightening feeling, too. It might help. He started to shiver. She actually turned toward the exit 1 millisecond before she realized that she was heading out to get him a blanket. What was wrong with her? Focus. Do you have anything to say? She asked gently when his breathing was more even. His answer came out in exhausted, breathy gasps.
It's not me. Swear, I'm not planning anything. Don't know the drug guy. Wish I could help. Really, really, really wish I could help. Really.
You're showing some resistance to this method. So maybe we'll try something new.
existence? He croaked in disbelief. You think I'm resisting?
Honestly, I'm a little worried about messing up your head with hallucinogens. Seems like there's already enough trouble up there. She tapped her fingers against his sweaty scalp as she spoke. Maybe we have no choice but to try old school. She continued to absently tap his head as she glanced at the tray of tools on her desk. Are you squeamish?
Why is this happening to me?
Totally rhetorical. He wasn't looking for an answer to his broken whisper. She gave him one anyway. Because this is exactly what happens when you plan to release a lethal influenza virus in 4 American states, potentially killing 1 million American citizens. The American government takes exception to that kind of behavior. And they send me to make you talk. His eyes focused on her, horror suddenly overtaken by shock.
What the actual hell?
Yes, it's horrific and appalling and evil. I know.
Alex, really, this is nuts. I think you have a problem.
She got in his face. My problem is that you aren't telling me where the virus is. Do you have it already? Is it with De La Fuente still? When's the drop? Where is it?
This is insane. You're insane.
I'd probably enjoy life a lot more if that were true. But I'm beginning to think they sent the wrong doctor. We need the doctor for crazies here. I don't know how to get other Daniel to show up.
Other Daniel?
The one I can see in these pictures. She whirled and grabbed a handful from the desk, jabbing the computer once angrily in passing.
Look,
she said, shoving them toward his face, peeling off one after the other and dropping them to the floor. It's your body. She smacked one photo against his shoulder before letting it fall. Your face, see? But not the right expression. There's someone else looking out of your eyes, Daniel, and I'm not sure if you're aware of him or not. But there it was again, the recognition. He was aware of something. Look, for right now, I'd settle for you just telling me what you see in this picture. She held up the top photo. Other Daniel skulking in the back door of a Mexican bar. He looked at her, torn.
I can't explain it. It doesn't make any sense.
You see something I don't. What is it? Daniel tried to shake his head, but it barely moved. His muscles were so fatigued.
He looks like...
Like you.
No.
He whispered.
I mean, yes, of course he looks like me, but I can see the differences.
The way he said it, of course he looks like me. The transparent honesty again. But something still withheld. Daniel, do you know who this is? A real question this time. Not snark, not rhetoric. She wasn't playing psychiatrist, badly, now. She felt for the first time since the interrogation started that she was actually onto something.
It can't be,
he breathed, closing his eyes less out of exhaustion and more to block out the picture, she thought.
It's impossible.
She leaned forward. Tell me, she murmured. He opened his eyes and stared at her searchingly.
You're sure? He's going to kill people?
So natural, his use of the third person. Hundreds of thousands of people, Daniel, she promised, earnest as he was. She used the third person, too. He's got access to a deadly virus, and he's going to spread it for a psychopathic drug lord. He already has hotel reservations in your name. He's doing this in 3 weeks. A whisper.
I don't believe it.
I don't want to either. This virus? It's a bad one, Daniel. It's going to kill a lot more people than a bomb. There'll be no way to control how it spreads.
How could he do this? Why?
At this point, she was nearly 65% convinced that they were not talking about one of Daniel's multiple personalities. It's too late for that. All that matters now is stopping him. Who is he, Daniel? Help me save those innocent people. A different kind of agony twisted his features. She'd seen this before. With another subject, she would know that his desire to be loyal was warring with his desire to avoid more torture. With Daniel, she rather thought the war was between loyalty and wanting to do the right thing. In the perfect stillness of the night, as she waited for his answer, through the weak sound barrier of the foam, she clearly heard a small prop plane overhead. Very close, overhead. Daniel looked up. Time slowed down while she analyzed. Daniel didn't look surprised or relieved. The noise did not seem to signal rescue or attack to him. He just noticed it the way someone might notice a car alarm going off. Not relevant to himself, but distracting from the moment. It felt like she was moving in slow motion as she jumped up and raced to the desk for the syringe she needed.
You don't have to do that, Alex, Daniel said, resigned. I'll tell you.
Shh, she whispered, leaning over his head while she injected the drug, into the IV port this time. I'm just putting you to sleep for now. She patted his cheek. No pain, I promise. Understanding lit his eyes as he connected the sound to her behavior.
Are we in danger?
He whispered back. We. Huh. Another interesting pronoun choice. She'd never had a subject anything like this before. I don't know if you are, she said, as his eyes drooped closed. But I sure as hell am. There was a heavy concussion, not immediately outside the barn, but too close for her liking. She put the gas mask securely on his face, then donned hers and screwed in the canister. This time was no drill. She glanced at her computer. She had about 10 minutes left there. She wasn't sure it was enough, so she tapped the spacebar. Then she jabbed a button on the little black box, and the light on the side started blinking rapidly. Almost as a reflex, she covered Daniel with the blanket again. She shut the lights off, so the room was lit only by the white gleam of her computer screen, and exited the tent. Inside the barn, everything was black. She searched, hands out in front of her, until she found the bag beside her cot and, with years of practice guiding her, blindly put on all of her easily accessible armor. She shoved the gun into the front of her belt. She took a syringe from her bag, jabbed it into her thigh, and depressed the plunger. Ready as she could make herself, she crept into the back corner of the tent and hid where she knew the darkest shadow would be if someone came in with a flashlight. She pulled out the gun, removed the safety, and gripped it with both hands. Then she put her ear to the seam of the tent and listened, waiting for someone to open the door or a window into the barn and die. While she waited, through the slow seconds, her mind raced through more analysis. This wasn't a big operation coming for her. No way any extraction team or elimination team worth its salt would announce its arrival with a noisy plane. There were better ways, quieter ways. And if it was a big SWAT-style team sent after her without any briefing, just busting their way in by sheer might, they would have come in a copter. The plane had sounded very small, a 3-seater at most, but probably 2. If a lone assassin was coming for her again, as had always been the case in the past, she didn't know what this guy thought he was doing. Why would he give himself away? The noisy plane was the move of someone who was lacking resources and in a very big hurry. Someone to whom time was much more important than stealth. Who was it? Not De La Fuentes. First of all, a small prop plane didn't seem like a drug lord's M.O. She imagined that with De La Fuentes, there would be a fleet of black SUVs and a bunch of thugs with machine guns. Second, she had a gut feeling about this one. No, she wasn't a lie detector. Good liars, professional liars, could fool anyone, human or machine. Her job had never been about guessing the truth from the subject's shifty eyes or tangled contradictions. Her job was breaking down the subject until there was nothing left but compliant flesh and one story. She wasn't the best because she could separate the truth from the lie. She was the best because she had a natural affinity for the capabilities of the human body and was a genius with a beaker. She knew exactly what a body could handle and exactly how to push it to that point. So gut feelings were not her forte, and she couldn't remember the last time she'd really felt something like this. She believed Daniel was telling the truth. That's why this exercise with Daniel had bothered her so much, because he wasn't lying. It wasn't going to be De La Fuentes coming after him. No one was coming after Daniel because he wasn't anything more than what he said he was. An English teacher, a history teacher, a volleyball coach. Whoever was coming for her. Why now? Had the department been tracking her all day and only just discovered her? Were they trying to save Daniel's life, having realized too late that he wasn't the guy? No way. They would have known that before they set her up. They had access to too much information to be fooled in this. The file wasn't entirely make-believe, but it was manipulated. They had wanted her to get the wrong person. For a moment, she felt a wave of nausea. She'd tortured an innocent man. She put that away quickly. Time for regret later, if she didn't die now. The columns reversed again. Elaborate trap, not real crisis. Though she did believe the situation with De La Fuentes was genuine, she no longer believed it was quite so urgent as she'd been told. Time was the easiest small change to make to a file. The tight deadline was a distortion. Low stakes again. Just her own life to save. And maybe Daniel's, if she could. Maybe someone else, that brilliant and unsuspecting kid who had taken her place at the department, was working on the real terrorist now. Maybe they didn't think she still had the ability to get what they wanted. But why bring her in at all, then? Maybe the terrorist was dead, and they wanted a fall guy. Maybe they'd discovered this doppelganger weeks ago and held him in reserve. Get the chemist to make somebody confess to something and tie a bow on a bad situation? That wouldn't explain the visitor, though. It had to be near 5 in the morning. Maybe it was just a farmer who liked to start the day early and knew the area so well that he didn't mind flying without radar through a bunch of tall trees in the pitch-black night, and then enjoyed a good crash landing for the adrenaline kick. She could hear Daniel's breath rasp through the gas mask's filter. She wondered if she had done the right thing putting him under. He was just so exposed, helpless. The department had already exhibited exactly how much concern they had for Daniel Beach's well-being. And she'd left him trussed and defenseless in the middle of the room, a fish in a barrel, a sitting duck. She owed him better than that. But her first reaction had been to neutralize him. It wouldn't have been safe to free him, she knew. Of course, he would have attacked her, tried to exact revenge. If it came to brute strength, he'd have the advantage. And she didn't want to have to poison him or shoot him. At least this way, his death wouldn't be on her hands. She still felt guilty. His vulnerable presence in the darkness, worrying at the edges of her mind like sandpaper against cotton, pulling threads of concentration away from her. Too late for second thoughts. She heard the faint sound of movement outside. The barn was surrounded by bushes with stiff, rustling leaves. Someone was in them now, looking into the windows. What if he just let loose with an Uzi through the side of the barn? He obviously wasn't worried about noise. Should she lower the table, get Daniel down in case the tent was sprayed with bullets? She had oiled the accordion bass well, but she wasn't positive it wouldn't squeak. She scuttled over to the table and cranked it lower as fast as she could. It did make some low bass groans, but she didn't think they would carry outside the barn, especially through the foam barrier. She scooted back to her corner and listened again. More rustling. He was at another window, on the other side of the barn. Her booby-trapped wires were inconspicuous, but not invisible. Hopefully he was only looking for a target inside. Had he gone to the house first? Why hadn't he gone in? Sounds outside another window. Just open it, she thought to herself. Just crawl inside. A sound she didn't understand, a hissing, followed by a heavy clank from above. Then, a thump, thump, thump. So loud that the barn seemed to shake. Her first thought was small explosives, and she hunkered down into a protective position automatically. But in the next second, she realized it wasn't that loud. It was just the contrast with the silence before. There was no sound of anything breaking, no glass shattering or metal tearing. Was the reverberation enough to break the connections around the windows or door? She didn't think so. Then she realized the thumps against the wall were moving up just as they stopped. Above her. Major hitch. He was coming through the roof. She was on her feet in a second, one eye to the seam in the tent. It was still too dark to see anything. Above her, the sound of a welding torch. Her intruder had one too. All her preparation was falling apart. She glanced back once at Daniel. His gas mask was on. He would be fine. Then she darted out into the larger space of the barn, bent low with her hands stretched out in front of her to find the objects in her way, and moved as quickly as she could toward the faint moonlight filtering through the closest window. There were milking stalls to maneuver around, but she thought she remembered the clearest route. She broke into the open space between the tent and the stalls, half running, and one hand found the milking apparatus. She dodged that and reached out for the window. Something tremendously hard and heavy threw her to the ground face first, knocking the wind out of her and pinning her to the floor. The gun flew away into the darkness. Her head thudded resoundingly against the concrete. Bright pops of light skittered across her eyes. Someone grabbed her wrists and pulled her arms behind her, then wrenched them higher until she guessed her shoulders were close to dislocating. A grunt escaped her lungs as the new position forced the air out. Her thumbs quickly twisted the rings on her left and right fourth fingers, exposing the barbs.
"What's this?"
a man's voice said directly above her, generic American accent. He changed his grip so he was holding both her wrists in one hand. With the other, he yanked off her gas mask.
"So maybe not a suicide bomber after all," he mused. "Let me guess. Those hot wires aren't connected to charges, are they?"
She squirmed under him, twisting her wrists, trying to get her rings in contact with his skin.
"Stop that," he ordered.
He clocked the back of her head with something hard, probably the gas mask, and her face smacked the floor. She felt her lips split and tasted blood. She braced for it. In such close quarters,